We talk to those who are dating, those in the process of courtship, helping to see Christian principles for choosing one's mate. Tonight we move up a little bit and talk to those who are perhaps a little further along, who are in the process of making your choice, maybe to those who are engaged, looking toward marriage, and even those who are recently married. Now the truth of the matter is that tonight's message and next Sunday night's message are really two halves of the same sermon. Tonight we want to sort of look at what the ideal Christian marriage is meant to be. What are the most important factors in its makeup? Then next week, we will look closely into the very heart of married life itself and some of the problems, those factors which tend to break up a marriage. Did you ever notice something unusual about a Christian wedding ceremony? How that it carries with it an unusual sense of solemnity. I'm not being sentimental tonight, but I want to tell you that though I have conducted that ceremony literally hundreds of times, wherever I go through the wedding ceremony, especially when I get to that place where tightly gripping the joined right hands of the bride and groom, I say to them, now with the authority vested in me, by the Methodist Church, and by the Commonwealth of Kentucky, I pronounce you husband and wife. I've done that hundreds of times, maybe 1,000, I don't know. But every time there goes through me a very awesome feeling. Now, you know what I'm talking about, because whenever you attend a wedding, you feel exactly the same way. You sort of get the feeling that you're on holy ground, don't you? Now, we don't feel that way about other human transactions. You don't feel like kneeling if you sign a contract for an automobile, or a house, or a job. Why is it then we feel a great sense of reverence, of wonder, when we watch two young people of opposite sex facing one another, taking those vows, and making a commitment to a lifetime decision, a commitment to love one another? I'll tell you why. Because no other human choice is filled with so much possibility in one direction or another. The opportunities are tremendous. The dangers are frightening. Here are two starry-eyed young people who have never really lived together before. They're going to say a few words to one another. They're going to sign a piece of paper. And then they're going to undertake to live together for the rest of their lives. They're going to start something absolutely new. They are going to start an original creation. They're going to begin their own home. Their union is going to result in the birth of new human beings who would never have been born in all eternity if these two had not made that particular decision and commitment to one another. Just think, the joining of those lives has frightening possibilities, as the ceremony says. Quote, for better or for worse. From this point onward, something tremendous is going to happen. They are going to join forces and join lives, and from this point on, the suffering of one is going to become the suffering of the other. The joy for one is going to be the joy and happiness of the other. If the husband fails, is a failure in his chosen profession, the humiliation and the economic burden is going to come on the wife. If one of them falls into some kind of disgrace, the other one will have to share the embarrassment. No wonder then in this high and hallowed and awful moment, no wonder the mothers cry and dads bite their lips. The whole point of the undertaking is the terrific risk that's involved. For each partner, you see, is not only anxious to share his joys, but he is saying, I am now making myself absolutely vulnerable to your sorrows, your failures, your suffering. No wonder we tremble. No wonder there's a holy hush, a solemnity about a wedding ceremony. You see, it's a terrible risk. And it's for the highest stakes, and it's for keeps, this gamble. Oh, how wise and how beautiful is the wording of that ceremony when it says, in the light of all that I've been saying, quote, it is therefore not to be entered into unadvisedly, but reverently, discreetly. Now get this. And in the fear of God. Now what are the most important factors which you should carry with you into this honorable estate? If you want to make a good Christian marriage. I'm going to be very simple tonight. Surprisingly simple. This morning we had the enemies of the home all beginning with the letter I, so you could remember them. Tonight we're going to talk about some C's, some double C's. The good factors that make up a good Christian marriage. All with the letter C, so that you can remember them easily. Now the first one I've already partially covered in my introduction. I wanted to kind of sneak it up on you and set the tone for the rest of the message. I wanted to get you in a certain kind of a mood. What I was going to say tonight. So the first factor for a solid Christian marriage is C for concept. The right concept of what a Christian marriage really is. The concept of commitment. Now I can't possibly overemphasize the importance of this. One of the great troublemakers today is the mirage of marriage. You know what a mirage is? You look down on a hot day over a desert place and you see a mirage. You see pools of water. You see an oasis. You see buildings and palm trees and a shimmering gold city out there. And then you rush toward it and it becomes a mirage. The great troublemaker today is that so many, even Christians, enter into marriage not knowing what it really means, not understanding, and it becomes a mirage to them that disappears. It blows up in their face. It's gone. For us Christians, marriage is a sacred commitment to a permanent partnership. It's not, as the world would have it, a contract made between two consenting parties. Oh no, that's not the biblical sense of marriage. A contract between consenting parties to be later broken off if things don't go as they plan. You see, if it were merely a contract, there'd be an escape clause. But there's no escape clause. For better, for worse, for richer, for poor, in sickness and in health. Now that covers every possible eventuality in either direction. And to top it all off, far from being something temporary, we pledge this, quote, so long as we both shall live. This is what makes a Christian marriage a religious experience. You see, it is an act of commitment. It's religious because it's commitment. It's religious because it's unconditional commitment. Marriage is not Christian at all if you are entering it on a partial basis, on a conditional basis, sort of with your fingers crossed as you take the vows. Now, this is exactly where Christian marriage is so totally different from the modern trends of marriages today. This is where we Christians have a sharp break with the whole basis of the new morality, even as that new morality is presented even within the context in some places of Christian theology. You see, the concept of Christian marriage includes that this act of total, unconditional commitment to one another is fundamentally of a public, community, and congregational character. That is, it is a commitment made before the congregation, and it is made valid by the participation of the congregation or the community. This is what makes a Christian marriage different. The new morality says, if you are in love with one another, then it's all right to go ahead and have full sex relations. After all, quote, it's just as if you were married in God's sight. Some would reverse it by saying, it's the very fact of having sex relations which makes us married. Oh no. The Christian concept requires a public declaration which involves the couple with the congregation and the community. The couple stands in public before people and they say to one another that they're totally committed to one another. And the congregation or the community seals this commitment. And they say, yes, this commitment is true, and from henceforth this man and this woman are no longer available to anyone else. Now this Christian concept of total commitment is a very important thing to go into marriage. This gives us the proper understanding of what it's all about. Marriage can be the scene of wonderful affection. It can also be the place of terrible friction. The point is that marriage is not something into which two people, beautifully matched, completely compatible, somehow find each other and they get together for life and, quote, then they live happily ever after. Instead, it's a sacred institution where two persons, realizing that they are sinners, redeemed sinners, selfish, very imperfect, they commit themselves to love each other for life. Young people, remember that compatibility is not actually a prerequisite to marriage. It is actually an achievement in marriage. Now, all this has been rather theoretical. But I find that in counseling young people prior to their marriage, this sea of the concept of total commitment, the Christian concept of marriage, is of the utmost importance. And my advice to you tonight, as dating couples, as those who are engaged or on the way to engagement in marriage, is that you talk over very carefully, in detail, specifically, what I've covered in general tonight, and that your concept of marriage, you bring it right out in the open before one another, and that each of you know the role that the other is expecting him to play in marriage, so that you can fulfill those roles, and you can discuss them and agree upon them beforehand. The sea of concept, the concept of commitment to marriage, is tremendously important. And it's one of the factors that go to make up a good, solid Christian marriage. Now, you're going to be surprised at my second C. It's so simple. You're going to be utterly disappointed. You expected a long sociological discussion tonight. The second C is character. Doesn't that sound trite? But believe me, it's far from trite. Good Christians with good Christian character make good marriage partners. After all, a marriage is no better than the material that goes into it. You can take statistics on marriage and studies and you will find all kinds of documentation for this. The person who has the fruits of the Spirit in his life is going to make a success of his marriage. On the other hand, the carnal, self-centered Christian who doesn't get along with himself, who doesn't get along well with anyone else, who is a problem to himself and to his peers, is hardly likely to change just because he goes through a marriage ceremony. How naive some of the young people here are tonight to think that marriage is going to solve your inner spiritual problem. To think that because you get married, it's going to take care of your basic lack. Your basic lack of character and spiritual depth. That you are going to find in your partner something that will make up for your own spiritual weaknesses and lack. The greatest folly of young people is along this line. The greatest folly is to think that the thrill and the high voltage of physical attraction between them is going to override all the defects of character in themselves and in their partner. And the facts of the matter are exactly the opposite. The fact of the matter is that selfishness and impatience and anger and the inability to say I'm sorry and the inability to forgive, all these can take the thrill out of the sexual side of marriage and turn the brightest flames into distasteful ashes. The most important single factor in marriage is the character of the person you are marrying and your character that you take into marriage. Let me put it in the form of a question. Do you have the integrity of spirit and the depth of character to make a success of your marriage? To me, that's the most important question, barring none. It really boils down to that. Do you have the character, the spiritual commitment, the depth of spiritual resources to make a success of your marriage? Now, when I say character, I mean more than standards and values. There are many people with very high and holy standards, but they're awfully hard to live with. I mean the whole outlook of a person, his ability to get along with others, his disposition, his ability to let the Holy Spirit control his temper and his temperament. What do I mean by the Christian character that it takes to have marriage? Let's look at those characteristics we read a few moments ago. The characteristics of love, as described in 1 Corinthians 13. Love is patient.
it suffereth long. Be careful about marrying someone who is a short sufferer, who is very short on suffering. Love is kind, says the verse. Is the person that you intend to marry, the one you are going with, are they essentially a kind person? That's an important question. Love is not jealous or envious. Philip says it is not possessive. There's hardly a week passes when some young person doesn't come to see me about the problem of their partner's extreme jealousy. Now, there's a healthy concern. There's a natural spirit of competition to feel strongly about anyone who would cut in on you and on your love. I'm not talking about that. But I'm talking about a whole range of extreme jealousy. And let me tell you, in your courtship, if you find that in your partner, the yellow lights of caution are flashing on at a rapid rate. A warning signal is on of trouble ahead. It hasn't been long before a young wife came to me in great agony. She said, "Dr. Seaman, you won't believe this, but I'm a veritable prisoner to my husband. He doesn't want to let me out of his sight. He accuses me of having all kinds of affairs with anybody. If the milkman or the newspaper man or the gas man comes to the door, I'm accused. Any male. He is, quote, insanely jealous of me. He is fiercely possessive." Love is not jealous or possessive. What about you? What about the partner that you are thinking of marrying? Love is not proud or haughty. It's not selfish or rude. Love does not demand its own way or seek its own rights. Do you always have to have your own way? Do you always have to be right? There are some people who cannot be wrong. They have to be right. They're all so touchy about ever being wrong. Does your partner have to have his own way? Does she know how to give in graciously, accommodatingly? Love does not insist on its own way, its own rights. Love, says Paul, does not lose its temper. One of the most amazing things is to listen to the stories of what temper can do to a marriage. I'm always amazed, I must confess, at college graduates, educated people, those with postgraduate degrees, and the most childish behavior they revert to because of uncontrolled carnal anger at their marriage partner. Now, one of the college faculty members likes to kid me a lot on something he pulled on me about a year ago. One day, he walked into my office and had a great big black eye. Now, I forget how he got it, but anyhow, he came into the office and I looked at that eye. He strode right over to my desk. He said, "Pastor, I've got to have an appointment with you. I tell you, this is it. My wife and I, we've come to the end of the road. We've got to get some things straightened out. Look at this." And he went on and on like this, you know. He said, "How soon can you make an appointment?" Well, I just began leafing through my book, you know, and I started to sign him up and gave him a date and a time. Then he looked at me and he began to laugh and laugh and laugh. It was all a great big joke. Now, he likes to tell it in front of others, and every time he does that, he says the thing that amazes me. He says, "You know what amazed me about the pastor is that when I said that to him, there wasn't the slightest flicker, there wasn't a shadow that passed on his face. He just took it so calmly, he just walked over and said, 'All right, when can we get together?'" But you see, when you've seen and heard what I have, you're no longer shocked. Let me ask you, what in the world is it that can take two starry-eyed young people who look at one another with a look that only the poets can describe, and within a matter of months can reduce that relationship to the point of physical violence? I'll tell you what can do it. Carnal, uncontrolled anger can do it. Be honest now. With your temper, are you really fit to get married? Are you really fit to be a married partner? with the kind of uncontrolled anger that your partner has? Do you think that he or she has the character to build a good marriage on? Paul continues, love does not keep an account of evil. Ah, but what about being married to someone who does keep an account of evil? Who never forgets? Who muddles every disagreement by reaching back into the past and dragging out some previous failure and clubbing their partner over the head with it? Favorite indoor sport of many people. Not so long ago, a young lady came to see me. She tells me about her fiancé. Before this young man became a Christian, he had, quote, gone all the way with a girlfriend in high school. He's now a fine, deeply committed, completely transformed young man, studying for the ministry. I've forgiven him, she says, but I just can't forget this. Keeps coming up. Keeps bothering. Now, I hear this many, many times from both the sexes. And in today's world, it's something that I'm sad to say, one has to almost get used to. I hear it. You know what I tell people like this? I say, look, if you cannot really forgive and really forget, then you'd better find someone else. Either forget it or forget him or forget her. Because you see, a thing like that is a deadly weapon in the hands of an angry mate. Ah, but it takes Christian character. It takes the kind of love that God had at the cross to forgive someone. Paul says it takes that kind of love. Paul says in Ephesians 4:32, be kind one to another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. And when God forgives, he remembers our transgressions against us no more. Do you have the kind of a character that will forgive, that will forget? Love doesn't keep an account, doesn't keep a record book, doesn't keep piling up clubs there in the bag, so that when there's an argument, a disagreement, love doesn't reach in for one of those clubs to hit the partner over the head. Love believes all things, bears all things, hopes all things. This kind of love never fails. It outlasts everything. Ah, but this kind of love is more than natural human love. It is divine agape love. And Romans 5:5 assures us that that kind of love is shed abroad, is poured out into our hearts by the Holy Spirit that he gives unto us. Now, what am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that if you think that marriage is a kind of a miracle drug for all your deficiencies, that it will fill all your needs, that it will answer all your problems, take care of your spiritual deficiencies, you are terribly wrong. You will be no better a marriage partner than you are a person. If you're the kind of Christian that's moody and touchy and irritable, you will be a moody, touchy, irritable marriage partner. If you're the kind of a Christian that gets along well with others, has the fruits of the Spirit growing out of your life, then you have some of the most important ingredients that make up a good Christian marriage. First, the concept of total commitment. Second, Christian character. Finally, the third great ingredient, I believe, is the courage to change. The courage to change. I don't know of anyone who has a ready-made happy marriage. Don't you believe it when they say marriages are made in heaven? They're not. They're made right down here on earth, and they take all the human determination and all the divine grace that is possible. And this means the willingness to change. I mean by this the willingness to grow together. Like a great tree, marriage keeps on growing and expanding as long as the couple continues to grow. And growth in understanding, in self-understanding, and understanding of your partner, and growth in self-acceptance and acceptance of your partner is the great hallmark of a couple who are determined to have the best possible marriage. Now, this is something we forget. We forget that love not only never fails, but love never stands still. Love keeps on moving. It is not something static. It's something very dynamic. This kind of love is compared in the New Testament to the relationship between Christ and His church, the relationship between the human spirit and God. Like the Christian life, this kind of love is a moment-by-moment process. Love is the quality of relationship between two persons, and since relationships are constantly changing, that love is constantly changing. And our love also will change, and we forget this. Did you ever hear about a couple who maybe have been happily married for many years? And then all of a sudden you hear about trouble. Maybe you hear about a breakup, even a divorce. And people say, my, how did it happen? After all those many years of happy marriage, we forget that the same principle of growth that operates for our spiritual lives operates for our married lives. If your love is not growing in marriage, it'll be shrinking. If you are not coming closer all the time, then you are drifting apart. Marriage is never static. It's dynamic. And that's why one of the great enemies to marriage is indifference. The cold feeling, well, I'll just let her go her way, and I'll go my way. This is one of the great enemies, because it means we're drifting apart instead of growing closer together. So that what was once real, wonderful love can die. It can be killed by failure and by neglect and by the failure to grow. Now, Helen and I have discovered through the years that this is an ever-changing process. But it's particularly true as you grow older and as you have your children and they begin to grow older. We've discovered that everything keeps changing. I remember when our eldest daughter, Sharon, married and left home. Everything was changed. The whole home was turned upside down. Everyone's relationship changed. Steve became the oldest. He's not here tonight, I can talk about it. See, then he could lord it over the younger one, you see. Everything got changed. All our relationships. Everything was topsy-turvy for a while. Now, this is only a sample of what happens. Every new place of work, every birthday on the calendar of ourselves or our kids, you see, brings about great changes. And love has 1,001 different faces and different facets. And it requires courage and a willingness to change and to work out on every new plateau of relationship a new level of love. And you will find every new change relationship brings the opportunity for greater conflict, or for more maturity and a deeper love. You see, what happens as you grow together is a wonderful thing. The courage to change, the willingness to grow, slowly but surely, the true nature of marriage begins to dawn on you, and sometimes it takes many years. What is it? You begin to learn to love your partner as he wants to be loved, not as you want to love. And this brings its own great reward. Learning to live for the happiness of your partner, for the other person. Learning to do the things that will please them and make them happy. Learning to love them as they want to be loved, not as you think you would like to love them. So let's be very practical tonight as we bring the message to a close. Let me talk to some young married couple here tonight, where maybe things are a bit stormy. They haven't been going quite so well. You've been having a rough time of it lately. Let me give you a doctor's prescription tonight as you leave this service. I challenge you to go out from here and say to yourself, both of you, for the next few days, I'm going to say and do and be all the things that will make her happy, the things that will please him. You're going to be surprised at the results. The fact is, you might be so happy for those few days that you'll want to extend it for a few more days, and then for a few more. And if you discover this secret, believe it or not, you'll have a happy Christian marriage.